You're listening to Rust Belt Running.
Running is what makes me realize that, like, I'm a human being who is worth something.
That is not a good measurement of my value as a human.
We get between 8 and 10,000 additional comments, and I read every one of them.
So you had to run Sand Run for your first. You become race director and take it out.
it's got to be old guy naked in the locker room.
I get to spend time with my friend Adam. I get to do something with my friend.
Right now, I'm not thinking much beyond what I'm going to be drinking next week at this time.
Coleslaw on a taco is not taco, it's barbecue.
And so we'll be discussing tonight with some occasional swear words from Andrew because he's upset, and that's okay.
I know him as the biggest Kid Rock fan around.
You ran that.
Oh, dear God.
You're listening to Rust Belt Running. I'm Adam Wheeler. You can find me on social media at WheelsUpInCLE. Joined, as I always am, by Andrew Hedinger. You can find him on social media at AndrewRunsALot. If you want to find the podcast on social media, you can find us at Rust Belt Running.
Before we go any further, let's take a quick break to tell you a little bit about what we do with run coaching. Adam, why don't you tell us about it?
It's personalized run coaching. It takes into account the schedule that you have to get your runs in, the goals that you have, as well as the base that you come to us with. You talk to us about what it is you want to be doing, the time that you have to do it, and we come up with a personalized plan that fits your needs, works on you towards your goals, and helps provide a bird's eye view on your training to make sure that you don't plateau, to make sure that you're doing the correct training that's appropriate for you, and to get you showing up on race day confidence that you're going to be ready to hit your race goals.
So to learn more about how we can help you hit your race goals, go to rustbeltrunning.com. There you can find out about our different levels and coaching, find out more about us as runners and coaches, or you can support the show with buying merch, a sweatshirt, a patch that you can iron on to your singlet for that race that you're running soon. Maybe you don't want people knowing that you listen to us, but regardless, support the show. But for now, sit back and enjoy the rest of this episode.
Andrew, how are you doing, bud?
Oh man, I'm fantastic. We're getting ready to talk to a dude on the other side of the world, and I'm really looking forward to that. I think this is the first time that we've left the North American continent.
So
we're expanding our reach. We're talking to Mark Freeman. I got his name right this time. I didn't call him a different author like I did on Instagram a couple weeks ago.
That was a rough couple weeks.
That was real bad. I messed up my physical therapist's name, and one of our good friends and author messed up his name. He gave us a book to give away a couple years ago when we had him on in the middle of the pandemic, a signed copy. And I made the mistake of not putting only eligible to people in the contiguous United States, and a dude from India won.
Yes.
And figuring out how to ship a book to India is not easy, and it took forever.
Yeah.
And it's not cheap. So nope. That ended up costing me like $40. And it took like 3 weeks to get there.
That's when we were making no money whatsoever on anything that we do.
Yeah, that was just personal money.
Yeah.
But how are you doing?
I'm good. Just enjoying the consistent state of fatigue that is marathon training right now. So I'm good.
Oh, that sounds exciting. So we're staying up late so that we could hop to Malaysia and talk to Mark Freeman today. We're going to talk about his book, You Are Not a Rock, which is awesome. We have been talking a lot about it recently on the podcast, so we wanted to have you on. So Mark from Malaysia, good morning to you. It's 8 o'clock in the evening here. It's 9 o'clock in the morning to you. You said you had a good breakfast. What did you eat this morning?
Oh, so yeah, good evening, guys. It's good to see you.
Thank you.
You know, this morning, the last couple of mornings, I've had things to do in the mornings. And this morning, I didn't have any early meetings. So I went and did the hotel breakfast. But what I love, and this has been consistent across hotels, because I'm in a hotel today. I had some business to do in Kuala Lumpur. So I'm in the big city and staying at a hotel. But what's amazing about hotel breakfast in Malaysia, because Malaysia is so international, every hotel breakfast I've been to so far, and it must be so much work on the chefs. They make everything. There'll be a station for like a Chinese breakfast, and then there's a station for a Japanese breakfast. There's Korean breakfast. Then there's like a Western European breakfast. And then there's a station that's an Indian breakfast, because there's so many people from all over the world in Malaysia that people are very particular about their breakfast, I find, in especially breakfast. And so the chefs just make everything. And so the breakfast buffets are always incredible. So I had everything for breakfast.
Had everything. I like it.
Yeah.
What have you found is your favorite type of breakfast so far? Because you've been jet setting for a while now.
What's my favorite breakfast? I mean, donuts are always, you know, I always check if a place has breakfast donuts. That's really important.
And oh, yes.
And absolutely, right? And I love breakfast personally, but when there's this kind of breakfast, I just get everything. I eat it all.
Like, do you do smaller portions of everything, or do you just do like
go for
a massive amount of everything, or in between?
I feel like I eat a lot, so other people's concept of a massive portion is my let's just do a little of everything. is that what when you're doing marathon training, does that mean big breakfast, or is that because you don't want to carry around a lot of food, but you also need a lot of energy? What are marathon training breakfasts like?
Well, the pre is not the, like the pre long run is not huge. But the post is typically a feast. Yes, I like to do. I'll do a few eggs over like a bagel. And then I get cold smoked salmon. I'll throw that over it as well, and maybe do like an avocado. And so I can get a little bit of everything, high protein, good fats, all of that. And then carbs from the bagels, obviously. And yeah, it's pretty good. Maybe like a little dish of fruit. And then I'm still hungry, so I'll find something else after those long runs. What about you, Adam? What's your do you have a go-to?
So for me, pre and post is always the same. I always do oatmeal with walnuts, raisins, and honey in the morning. And then immediately post-run or post-workout, if I work out right after my run, I'll do like a protein smoothie that I make. After that is when, depending on how much I've run that day, the real eating begins. And it's not necessarily about the size of one meal. It's more about how many small meals do I choose to go after for the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. So it might be a situation where I have the protein smoothie and an hour later, like I'm doing a serious, legit lunch, and then another serious meal before work. Because I'm in the service industry, so I tend to do my workouts in the morning, and then I work usually in the evening, so there's the gap in between. So one is I've got to make sure that I've recovered and fueled up from the run, but also I need to make sure that I'm not going to be starving through my shift at work.
Yeah.
And then depending on how well I've calibrated that, it might be a very big dinner after I get home. So, yeah, it's more about...
because you work late.
Yeah, it's tough. But I've made it work. It's my 13th year doing this, and I've figured out a way to make it all work so that I can get all the food I need and still be able to sleep and be able to do all this. It's a well-oiled machine.
That is important though, right? Like you hit it there, the actually getting all the food in and getting to sleep, because you can't, you don't have to like stay up. Oh, I've got to like stay up and cook all this and eat all this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the sentence there though, when you said and then the real eating begins. that's just beautiful. Like you just know there's a bit like that's the pivotal moment in like watching a movie, and you're like, oh, what's going to happen next?
the action starts. Yeah.
Yes.
So I want to get this action started. Adam hit something huge talking about eating and sleeping, and, you know, we're finding ways to, you know, put that into our time that we have. So we're going to dig into, kind of what the ideal time inventory is, maybe how to set it a little bit, some of the tips and tricks without giving away your book. I want, you know, people to go and purchase it as well. But, you know, you're an expert on this and you did it so eloquently, and it really did have a massive impact on my life, which is why we talk about it so much. But before we get into it, I want to read one sentence out of here, and I want to ask you if this is about you or not. You're talking in this about feeling pain in your knee while you're running. You're going through a couple different scenarios with it. Where the pain might be coming from. And you said it could be my gait or how my foot contacts the pavement or the shoes I'm wearing. Or maybe it's because of that time I fractured my ankle in a karate tournament as a teenager, but didn't go to the doctor or tell anybody that my foot turned purple. Did that happen to you?
Yes. Oh yeah. That's totally real. We were playing around before the karate tournament. Just because I was in high school, we were playing around, like, I don't know, like, you just would, like, you're fighting. Yeah, you're, and so we were doing, like, jump kicks and stuff like that. And I just landed on my ankle wrong. And, like, it was pretty, like, it seemed like a sprain at the time, or just, but, it, like, it seemed bad. But then I still did the tournament. And then in the weeks ahead, it was very, very purple. And for years after that, I could snap my ankle, kind of my foot. It was more actually down into the foot. There was this spot that for years I could crack, which didn't seem like it should crack.
Typically not.
Typically not, right? Yeah.
It's funny. My mom knows if I'm home and my brother's home, my mom will know which of the two of us is walking up the stairs based on the distinctive cracking of our ankles, because we both sprained our ankles in high school. It's funny that you talked about, you know, like messing around like high schoolers would be doing, because my brother did exactly the same thing. I think in eighth grade, the basketball coach stepped out of the gym for a minute, and my brother got the bright idea that if one of his friends got like on all fours and he jumped off his friend's back, he could dunk. And he got to rim height, but he didn't really gauge the distance well enough, and he didn't hit the rim, and he came down and he landed on his wrist. And as my mom describes it, his arm looked like an S.
Ooh, man.
Yeah, so
oh, wow.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I don't have any good stories like that. I don't have anything. I'm trying to think. I don't think I ever, like, I mean, I did stupid stuff all the time when I was young, but I don't think it ever led to me, like,
no ER visits.
I don't have any noises my body perpetually makes because of stupid stuff I did when I was younger.
That's fine. That is fine.
I feel like I missed out on something in my childhood. Now,
I don't know, man. 70-year-old you is probably going to be happy about that.
So, one reason we want to get into this is we feel sometimes people say stupid things like, if it's important, you'll make time for it, without offering any tools as to how to make time for it. There's so many of those sayings that you hear and mantras you hear from people, you know, that are so successful, especially in the grind culture that we have, you know, in the world in this day and age. But nobody gives you the tools to do it. So what was some of, I mean, you spell out a lot of it in the book, but when we're talking about the time, ideal time inventory, give us a little bit of what you think the basics of that are as you wrote it.
Yeah, I think, and one of the things to position people, I guess, yeah, if you read the book or you're, you know, you might read the book, is to understand this exercise is at the back of chapter two.
Yeah, it's early.
It's really early on, precisely because, and it's coupled with looking at how we spend our time and energy, and then how we want to be spending our time and energy. And that's because we so often do not understand how we're actually spending our time and energy in life. But then also, we don't get into that really granular look at well, if I want to go in this particular direction in life, like, what am I actually going to be spending time and energy on? It's like we keep saying, I want to go to this place. I want to go to this place. But then we never look at a map and say, well, if I actually want to go to the place, I need to take, you know, this step to this direction. And then we're, you know, going to take this step to this direction. And then I'm going to put a lot of time into this and that and actually break it down. Kind of like we're building a map. And so unless we build that map, it's just not strange that we don't end up in that destination. And so that's what it's really about. And then also on a really important level, so often when we're looking at something like mental health or just personal change in our lives, we can get so reactive, where we're just reacting to a problem, reacting to something we don't like. That consumes all of our time and energy. And then we wonder why we're not going where we want to go and we're just stuck with this problem. But it's because we put the problem in charge of how we spend our time and energy. And so the exercise is also to help us make that shift to what do we actually want to be growing? And then how are we going to spend time and energy on that?
I love that idea that you talk about it in terms of making, creating a map to get there, because I'm going to read something that you put down in the chapter. I think in that chapter that the exercise then accompanies. In a sense, taking on challenges is impossible with the brain or body we have, but pushing through them in a healthy way changes us, and we develop the body and brain we need to make overcoming those challenges possible. And I love that idea of you have to have that map and understand that, like, where you're at now, if that's not where you want to be, it's not just a matter of, okay, I make the commitment to getting there, but it's actually, you're going to have to go through those actual changes of changing the brain, changing the body to get there. And having that map is really that guide to getting you there so that you know how you're going to have to make those changes.
Exactly. I think, and this has come up a lot recently, just in conversations. and I think, and maybe it's in part that we talk much more about mental health. People know much more about mental health and personal development. Like you mentioned grind culture a moment ago. Like, people know all the words about grinding to get where you want to go and working on recovery or working on personal development. But I find it so important to recognize that these are practices. This is like learning a musical instrument. And if somebody said, oh, I know everything about the cello, they'd be like, I know the cello. And we'd be like, okay, oh, can you play something for me? And then they went, oh, well, I don't play. Like, I just know everything. Mm-hmm. We would not see that as knowing everything. And I think we've gotten into a position sometimes with mental health and you know, personal development, where it's like, oh, well, I know everything about it, but I don't actually do it. And the ideal inventory is looking like very practically at, okay, well, if that's the direction you want to go, what are you going to do? Like, what's the practice? How are you going to practice the cello? How are you going to do the thing that takes you there? And sometimes it looks kind of, it's not inspiring or particularly innovative when you break down the practice. But that's the reality of it. It is just taking steps in a direction we actually want to go. And then enjoying the process of going there.
You know, you hit on something, though, that I think is really powerful there. And, you know, thinking about it as a run coach, you talked about how it's not necessarily innovative or inspiring. You know, Andrew and I have talked about this when we're laying out our workouts for our athletes. Run coaching is, I don't want it to make it sound like we don't need to be utilized, but like, run coaching isn't necessarily like a complicated thing. Most run coaches give their runners relatively the same workouts. There's going to be variations of them, but a lot of times it's like you're laying out stuff and you don't want to really try to reinvent the wheel because it's pretty proven what works and gets runners to where they need to go. Andrew and I talk a lot about, you know, having to work within our clients' schedules, but beyond that, we're providing a lot of the same workouts that many coaches would provide. But you don't necessarily have to be innovative to get there. It's just simply it needs to be practiced consistently. And it's understood with physical practice. It's not necessarily understood with a mental health practice. And yet it doesn't have to be complicated. It just needs to be executed.
Exactly. It's a great point, Adam. It's so useful to look at it like we would recognize with physical fitness. And just like somebody might get caught up in searching for hours online to find but what's the best pre-workout that's really going to help me succeed at my workouts? But yeah, the reality is it is going to be some pretty simple stuff. And that's also why I find I like the ideal inventory exercise, because it also helps us step away from, I thought I had to go and do this special thing first. But actually, all the things that are on here, I can do them right now. That going that place I want to go, it's actually accessible. And it is going to be, I've got to, lay out these workouts and get running.
Yeah. So without giving give away as much as you'd like. I usually give away
a lot of this exercise because that's why I mentioned it being a chapter two, because all the hard work happens after.
Right.
So can you kind of take us through the exercise a little bit? Adam and I know it, in the way I've kind of explained it, I've kept it kind of pared back and basic working with our athletes. I'm just like, look, if they're struggling to get workouts, I'm like, look, you have 24 hours in a day. That does not change. How are you currently using it? Mm-hmm. And being honest with yourself, you went through in your exercise a lot of different compulsions, we looked at as you're looking more at mental health. But in my journey, when I was a smoker, I was very honest and I put smoking cigarettes in my ideal time inventory as something I didn't want in there. So how can athletes kind of use it? And well, what is it exactly? As much as you want to give away, and kind of how can we use that?
I'll tell everybody how they can do it. the whole thing. Then the real work starts. You want to do both. So you grab two pieces of paper, and the first one is going to be your inventory. The second one's going to be your ideal inventory. And you draw out, I like to draw bubbles. You draw out bubbles that represent the time and energy you spend on activities. So for instance, somebody's spending, 8 hours a day in a job. They might draw a big bubble in the circle because they're like 8 hours every day at this office. But then they might also draw a bunch of bubbles within that circle that represent how they spend their time, at the job. If they're, spend half the day ruminating in their head and scrolling through their phone, then you draw a bubble to represent that. And then you draw all these bubbles to represent time and energy, and you can have them overlap, where things connect, small bubbles for things that you don't spend much time on, big bubbles for things that get a lot of time and energy. And so, you draw out how you're actually doing it right now. And then you take the second piece of paper, and this is going to be your ideal inventory. And now you draw bubbles as well, these circles, but they're to represent what you want to be giving your time and energy to. And so you might shrink some of the ones that were on the original inventory and grow some of the small ones, but really starting to see those things you want to drop and those things you want to cultivate in your life. And then once you've got it in front of you, I always suggest people explain the story of it out loud, even if you're doing it alone. Because also, again, when you actually hear yourself explain how you're spending your time and energy, you might be surprised. But also then when you hear yourself explain where you want to go, again, you might get a chance to question some of it, because maybe when you hear it out loud, you're like, do I really want to do that? But you might also see that, that some of that sounds kind of simple. And then the real work begins, the real eating begins. And then the challenges and tasks you line up to take your life to where the ideal inventory is how you're actually spending your time and energy.
I think one thing that's to just kind of throw this in there. Nobody has to see this. So be honest.
No.
Honesty and specificity make this more effective. If there's things you're embarrassed to put on there, because we all have things we maybe aren't proud of and spend time, you specifically mentioned porn in yours. That may not be something you want to discuss with your run coaches, but it may be something that you need to put on there as something that you want to, you're spending too much time doing. So,
absolutely. Yeah, it's a really good point to bring up. And porn is a great example, because yeah, if somebody's devoting an hour or two a day to that, yeah, that's a big chunk of time and energy that, you know, there's all sorts of potential to use that time and energy for something else. But also it could be putting a lot of pressure on training or hobbies, relationships, etc. Yeah, you don't have to share it with everybody. And one thing also related to this, it's really important to also look at how you're spending your time and energy inside your head. Because if sometimes people will write something like, oh, look, my ideal inventory, I do all of this. You know, why am I still anxious? Why am I always distracted? But you've also got to look at what you're doing inside of your head. Because if you're doing one thing outside of your head, but inside your head, you're time traveling, you know, trying to be a time traveling janitor and clean up mistakes in the past, or imagine all of the possible disasters in the future. That's being in two places at once takes a lot of energy, or being in 50 different places at once. However skilled you are at ruminating, that's got to be part of this as well.
What are some of the pitfalls that you see people encountering as they try to go from where they are to where they want to go? Because I think for a lot of people, it sounds like, oh, great, I have this ideal inventory now. It's just clear roads to getting there, and it never ends up working out like that. So what are some of the pitfalls that you see as people try to get there?
Yeah, it's one of the things we often try to do is we think it's just then about kind of getting angry at ourselves or committing a lot, which we just see as this kind of emotional, stressful, intense experience. And the reality is it's going to be about actions, that your inventory and your ideal inventory are two points on a map. And then you're just going to walk between them. And so one thing that I'll often suggest to people if they're getting caught up in just saying, okay, tomorrow I'm going to do the ideal inventory. I'm going to do it. Is even setting aside the ideal inventory and saying, okay, that's the goal. But what does that translate into actions this week? Let's make those actions this week the goal. And so really you may have that ideal inventory and you could see it as a kind of far off goal. Really look at what's the goal this week in a very practical sense, in a very action-oriented sense. And then celebrate the hell out of those. So if you say, okay, that's my ideal goal, but you know, today this, you know, or this week, you know, I can't train that much, or I can't, you know, I haven't started this business I want to start, or I'm not in a relationship. Maybe somebody put on their ideal inventory, you know, like they're spending time with their family. They're married and they've got kids or something like that. But right now they're not there. So it's looking at, okay, but what are the steps you're taking towards that this week? Yeah. Let's make that the goal and celebrate that. Because we don't want to be like just like focused on that far off goal and then going, oh, I'm not there yet. Oh, this is so hard.
Mm-hmm.
Make it possible to be successful today and this week and this month.
Same concept there goes with marathon training. And I mean, I see it a lot where people will get in their own head because a workout didn't go well in February and your goal race is in October. It's like you can get so upset. I mean, even if your goal race is only 12 weeks out, like I've said it before, you don't train to run badass training runs. You train to run badass races. And, you know, this is kind of that same concept. You know, there's going to be slip ups. There's going to be days and weeks that, maybe you're in your own head or scrolling on the internet too much at work. And now you're stressed out because you've fallen behind. And, you know, that starts to like bleed into everything else. And, you know, we're going to take steps backwards in this. And it's important to give yourself that grace to, you know, come back and, you know, get the victory the next day that you're working on it.
Totally. I think one of our brain's favorite, so I often describe them as compulsions, but we could put any label on them we want. One of the brain's favorite ways to waste time, chase control, is just hating on us. And so I yeah. recognized I had an incredible self-sabotaging streak where essentially I would set a goal. It was like I would set a goal, or my brain would be like, hey, we should set this as a goal. And I'd be like, yeah, that's a great idea. But it only suggested it because it knew it was too far in the future. It was impossible. And then I wouldn't be at that goal by just trying to will myself there. And then I would hate on myself. And I could just, I should have done that, or I didn't do this. And I would just spend all that time hating on myself. So really, yeah, watch out for that. It's one of the brains. The brain loves to turn us into a problem to solve. And then we're just
God,
always,
is that true?
Yeah. Oh, I'm a problem. I'm such a problem. I'm such a problem. I gotta fix me. And it's just chasing that hit of control. And so with all this, even though, yeah, we're looking at, hey, how do I actually want to spend my time and energy? Make it so you can be there today. That it's actually much easier to change when we're successful at it today, rather than like, oh, I've got to put all this pressure on myself and hate myself, and then I'm going to change big. No, you can just be really happy with yourself today and then spend that success and kind of support of yourself on doing something different tomorrow. And then you can do it again and again.
I love that you just use that idea of spending that success, because as we were prepping for having you back on, I was reading through the notes that I had taken from when I read your book the first time. And you make an analogy about how doing things that reflect your values are essentially like going to the bank. Mm-hmm. And you learn to trust yourself by keeping on doing those things that reflect the values that you want. And that if you do things that go against them, you essentially withdraw. And then if you keep doing them, you get to deposit them. And then when it comes time to do something really big, really important, if you've continued to do that, you have that amount of trust in yourself to go, oh yeah, like I've been doing this. I can trust myself to do this big, scary thing because I've been doing those little daily actionable things repeatedly where I can trust myself to say, yeah, no, I can handle this. It's a big thing, but I've proven I can do the little things. And I was just, I was describing that to a coworker that I recommended your book to. She's going through just some like life changes in her life. And I'm like, you know, there's actually a guy that you should read, and this is why. And it was that example that I gave her.
So one, thank you for sharing it.
Oh, absolutely.
I think what's so useful about that too is how you see how we could turn what could be a deposit into the bank into a debt if we're just constantly looking at that big thing. So rather than celebrating those small things, we're constantly like, oh, I did a small thing and it doesn't count.
Right.
I haven't gotten where I need to go. And that some of that is like, how are we, like the judgments and the labels we're sticking on that as we go, like we can really see that as a step in the right direction, or we can spend the entire walk to the place we want to go just hating on ourselves for not being there. And then we get there and we're miserable. I'm like, oh, this sucks. So it's, yeah. Thinking about like, what am I depositing in the bank today? What am I teaching my brain today is something I always found really, really helpful.
God, gosh, I forgot how good this chapter is. I should have reread the entire thing. I love the analogy you have about when you are able to kind of we're talking about the pain of breaking your foot at the karate tournament. But we're looking for the fix for the pain, not to fix the maybe the actual root cause. And you use the analogy of a monster chewing on your leg. And so often we are looking for, we're looking to take away the pain of the monster chewing on your leg. And walk me through, you come up with the craziest analogies. You have velociraptors chasing us around mountains. Yep. And in this, we have monsters chewing on your leg. But you're kind of creating your ideal time inventory, what's the monster chewing on your leg to look out for?
Yeah. So first of all, the monster chewing on the leg story, that did not happen.
That's okay,
that won't speak. The karate did, the monster did not.
Yeah, the karate was real, but the karate was to train for the monster. So it speaks to the karate training that there was no monster chewing on my leg. Because to even get at that, and I just did a live stream on Sunday, and we were talking about this, and so what I explained there was that the absence or presence of a feeling is not a skill. You could also say that the absence or presence of a feeling is not the reality of where we are. Because the idea there is, like, if the monster's chewing on your leg, you can do things to get rid of the pain. That doesn't mean the monster is not there anymore. And so one of the things sometimes people will do on the ideal inventory, especially if they're struggling with something like anxiety, they might actually initially put on the ideal inventory like a circle for like anxiety free or not bothered by thoughts, or, you know, they might put on the inventory, you know, spending time on intrusive thoughts. And then on the ideal inventory, they might put like no intrusive thoughts. And just recognizing that not experiencing an emotion we don't like, not experiencing the pain, doesn't mean we've taken ourselves someplace useful. Doesn't mean we've learned a skill. So the example I used the other day, and you could probably make a running analogy of this, but I was using a rock climbing analogy, that if somebody is climbing a mountain and they're learning how to rock climb, they're learning how to climb a mountain, but they're finding it really challenging and really painful, and their muscles are really sore and their fingers are really sore and everything's chafing and they're kind of anxious being up high. If they get rid of the physical kind of pains they're feeling and the emotional pains they're feeling, that doesn't mean they've become a good rock climber. Doesn't mean they go, oh, okay, I can scale the most challenging mountains now because it feels good. And so when you're looking at your ideal inventory, we want to make sure we're looking at actual skills and actions, and watch out for going, like, looking at the ideal inventory and being like, well, it's just going to be about, like, I'm going to feel good, or there are going to be no bad feelings on my ideal inventory. No bad feelings doesn't mean you've developed the skills to do the things you want to do, or that you're actually in the place you want to be. And so that's with the monster in mind, what I'd keep an eye on.
Well, and you're going to have bad feelings because probably a lot of the things you're taking out of your current time is things that make you feel good but are bad for you, you know, mentally or physically. And like, if you're just gonna, you know, think you're just going to escape those feelings, again, to go back to me smoking. Yeah, that wasn't fun. I had a lot of bad feelings when that was. Adam was right there with me, receiving plenty of texts from me. But I think actually one of the things Adam put on here is, how do you recommend going about tracking the changes you're seeking to make? I think this kind of falls in line with that a little bit. because you know, I was journaling a lot because I knew I was going to have these bad feelings. I don't meditate. You bring up meditation a lot. I kind of use running and writing are kind of my ways of meditating and kind of clearing my head, being present with my thoughts. Those were things that I did to kind of track the bad feelings. And I let myself have those feelings because I felt that was a key part of this exercise and what was going to be transformative for me and other things that you went on to cover throughout the rest of the book. But there was supposed to be a question in there somewhere. I think I had it. But yeah, oh, how do you go about tracking the changes you're seeking to make?
Yeah, I think, no, it's a really important thing to look at, because if we are talking about the inventory and the ideal inventory as being two points on a map, you want to have a way to see, okay, are we moving in the direction we want to move on the map? I find it really important to track it through actions. And that's partially because, you know, for years of doing all sorts of things that weren't helpful for my mental health or helpful for life, I always thought those felt good and those felt right. So I knew I couldn't track progress by asking, like, oh, does this feel good? Like, does this feel like the thing I should do? Because that, you know, consistently, you know, I would talk myself into a hole where I did not want to be. So what I look at is, am I doing more of the thing I want to be doing? And so that's where that, what I was talking about earlier comes in, with really understanding what the ideal inventory looks like this week. Like, what are the actions this week? And then celebrating the hell out of them. That's how I would track it. Like, did I do that thing? Okay, I did it. Then I am moving in that direction. It could feel however it feels. Because also, even if it felt really good, I don't want to then stop. Because this comes up all the time. Like, I'll hear this from people a lot if they are exploring meditation. When they're struggling with something, they'll be like, oh, I heard about meditation. Like, how do I meditate? And then maybe they'll meditate for a bit. And then for all sorts of different reasons, they might be feeling better. And then they go, okay, I'm not going to meditate anymore. And they'll just drop it because they'll be like, oh, I don't need to. Or it also happens sometimes with physical fitness. Somebody may hate on something, like, oh, I really hate this, or oh, I hate that I'm out of breath. I'm going to go to the gym. And then they're like, oh, okay. Like, now I'm, you know, feel good walking upstairs again. I'll stop it.
Right.
Because they're tracking a feeling, not, hey, this is just a useful action I want to have in my life. And so, yeah, not tracking whether it feels good or whether it feels bad. Tracking, hey, these are things I want to do. And then the example I often use is a garden. It doesn't matter if you feel like the garden needs water, or it doesn't matter. Like, you also don't want to wait until the garden's shriveling up.
Right.
And if you're like, oh, well, it's green, I don't need to water it. Well, it's only green because you've been watering it. Keep giving it that water. So it's really understanding, how do we care for ourselves like a garden? Okay, I'm going to do that consistently. And so I don't run into a situation of that, like, really reactive bouncing back and forth.
Counterpoint, you can overwater a garden.
Oh, exactly. I always use that in the metaphor too. Because if we go, oh, this feels good, I'm going to do a lot of it. Well, no, yeah. It's learning. No, like, I did enough. I'm moving in the direction. Because we might go, oh, but like, it's not making tomatoes yet. Maybe I need to give it more water. And we water it and water it. That's not going to produce the tomatoes. So it's also that understanding of, like, hey, this week it needs this much water. I'm moving in the right direction. It doesn't matter that there's no tomato yet. I don't need to overwater it. I did what I need to do this week. I'm going to do it again next week. And so, like, continuing that process. Because, you can totally overwater it and be like, I just love watering. I'd be like, well, no, okay, like, that's great. But you've done enough.
I found out the hard way that you can I found out the hard way you can overwater flowers. I worked really hard a couple years. It was 2020. It was the summer of the pandemic, and I was bored, and I planted a garden and my backyard looked amazing, and I could not understand why some of the flowers weren't. I just picked ones I thought looked cool. I didn't pay attention to what they needed. I'm sure this continues to get more and more relevant, actually.
Yes.
Like some flowers need less water, some need more. And so as you're going through this and these feelings and these changes you're making, some of it needs, the garden is perfect.
Now you know why I love gardening, Andrew.
Gardening, understanding ourselves as a garden is, and you can really look at like that ideal inventory is showing you to how much to water that garden. Because sometimes it might be something we really like, but when you draw it out on there, you're like, oh, okay, actually it's not that big. I don't have to spend as much time watering this. But then something you draw is much bigger, you realize, oh, I spend no time watering that plant. Mm-hmm. And I've just drawn that it needs a lot of water. Okay, what am I going to do to take care of it? And so to continue the garden metaphor, one of the things I always talk about there too is what your fertilizer is. And so that's looking at how you're going to make the environment and the systems around you conducive to doing these things. That it might be about making changes in systems around you. It might be about, you know, making the soil better for growing those things you want to grow. We love to think like, I'm just going to do it all and I'm going to force myself into this through sheer willpower. But the reality is you can't plant a flower in soil that doesn't work for it and then just shout at it to grow. And actually, you know, you've got to look at yourself, like, what do I actually need to do these things? What'll make them easy? And it's okay to make these changes easy.
Do you ever watch Family Guy, Mark?
No. I know of it, but I've never watched it that much.
I'm envisioning there's a scene. It doesn't involve gardening, but it's just Peter Griffin being an idiot. He's the dad in the show.
Which is the show, so.
Yes. And I don't remember the full context, but he had a goldfish that he killed from giving it too much food, but then he was just sad. So he was just standing over the bowl, just giving it more food. And he's crying and he's like, and there's like food mounded over the fish bowl. And that's just kind of what I'm envisioning. Just somebody just shouting at a flower for not growing and then just watering it more and more and more and more until it's completely flooded and washed out and obviously is not going to be able to handle the water and is going to dry out and die. But that's just kind of what I'm envisioning as you're talking about that. And I mean, it's silly, but relevant.
It's 100%. No, it's that. you can probably see it. Like, this is too why, you know, even if somebody, you know, knows how to exercise, knows how to run, or so, it's so useful to work with a running coach. Because this is a neat quirk of humanity. We just get pointed in a direction and don't really have a stop switch.
Yeah.
And don't, like, we might just latch onto something and be like, okay, this is the thing I got to do. Okay, I'm going to do so much of it. To the point, you know, we'll get injured or we'll, you know, kill our goldfish or, yeah, we'll just build and build and build and build. Never stopping to go, oh, actually, that's enough. Oh, like I am going where I want to go. I can just enjoy this. I don't have to do it to the point of destruction. Yeah. So like having help from outside of our heads to say, hey, that's enough. Like it's going well.
Yeah.
As I was
on the power tools.
As I was essentially telling people that, you know, they don't need to hire us because we just write the same workouts every other coach does. I was really, you should hire us people. I was thinking like along those lines, Andrew and I talk about this. Neither Andrew and I were ever coached by running coaches. And so we've gotten to be very good runners, but we've done it by making a ton of mistakes.
And it's through making those mistakes, we've gained all that perspective that we then offer our clients of, yeah, listen, like, this much is good. If you keep doing it too much, all of a sudden it's bad and you're going to get hurt and you're not getting to your goals. And it's about providing that perspective and about that kind of like another set of eyes on training to say, you know, hey, you know, maybe we need to back off here a little bit or recognize this one bad workout isn't the end of the world because everybody has bad workouts. And that's really where, you know, it's like through conversations like this where we add that value of, it's not just about the X's and O's of training, but about the larger picture perspective of it.
Well, and to kind of piggyback that, you know, you were talking about drawing circles. So I think, you know, to go back with the gardening, I think many runners, as they're listening to this, are probably thinking on their time inventory, their running circle isn't big enough. And the reality is it may be too big. And I think that's something, if you need outside assistance or advice, then you need to seek that out to see if your time spent running is appropriate. Because again, everybody's probably like, oh, I got to fit running into my schedule somewhere, but that's not always what the problem is. There may be too much of it.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned the brain's incredible self-sabotaging streak earlier, and it can help to see how we can sometimes get hooked on being stressed, hooked on, you know, feeling like there's this problem I've got to fix. So if we've noticed that we consistently do that, an overarching principle that I find really useful with this work is always just asking, how do I make it easy? And letting it be okay, you know, if somebody's, you know, really, they want to incorporate, say, like a running practice more into their lives, to come, like, not, it's going to be hard enough. So to come at it with that perspective of, okay, how do I make it easy to fit this in my life? How do I make it easy to reach these goals? So then it's about, okay, well, what do I change? What supports do I need? Because we will often be like, oh, well, it's got to be this big thing, and I've got to do it, you know, like 123%, and then of course it's like the brain knows then, oh, okay, we're gonna struggle and we're gonna hate on ourselves and we're gonna be like, oh, I have this problem, I can't you know, stick with my running practice or stick with the things I want to do, so what would make it easy? And then it's going to be hard enough, even if you just make it easy.
So I'm kind of envisioning somebody going and making up their, you know, doing this exercise, and, you know, they go through a few weeks and they are still struggling with, you know, struggling with the size of their bubbles. How often should somebody kind of revisit this?
So it's a great thing to think about, to understand that you are picking a direction, and so you're kind of wandering through the wilderness, and you say, okay, I think this is the direction I want to go, but pick a date when you'll revisit it, and so you can really leave it open to yourself. If somebody is working on some maybe some pretty challenging mental health stuff, I might suggest like revisiting it in a month. But if you're just using this to plot out life, every 3 months, every 4 months, something like that, where you say, hey, I'm going to explore this. So you also give yourself that time to just explore it. I'm going to try this out. After that, if I see that it's difficult to stick on this path, what have I learned? Okay, then that's probably going to adjust some of my goals. Okay, let's revisit it. This is the direction I want to go in. And then you give yourself that chance to explore it.
Something I wanted to follow up with you on, you know, thinking about, we'll go back to the gardening and talking about conditions. You know, our time isn't just spent with ourselves. Our time is spent with people. And as you start to look at that ideal time inventory, as you're starting to look at changes you might need to make, some of those changes might involve spending less time with people who maybe aren't supportive of the changes that you're making or are just part of the changes that you need to make, period. What advice do you have for people as they start to do that and some of the conversations they might find themselves having? Because that's where things get really kind of dicey, because it's not just you inside your head, it's you with other people inside your head.
It's really important to consider other people when you're making this. Because, you interact in the systems with other people. Something that really helped me as I was exploring this was recognizing that I also had all sorts of compulsions just around language and other people in general. Always putting myself down or lowering the importance of what I wanted to do, being very passive in it. So I might, if there was something I wanted to do, but then somebody else was asking about something, I might describe the thing I wanted to do as something I needed to do. So kind of kicking off the responsibility for it. Like, I have to go do this thing. Or like somebody, maybe they want to work on their running practice and they're like, oh, my coach said I had to go and do this running thing. So they, rather than be like, I want to do this, I want to make space for this, kicking it off onto somebody else. And it really helped me to explore articulating what I wanted to do. And so that's one of the elements I'd look at around the ideal inventory. After you get it out there, how are you going to really own that and actually take up space with it? And so, there's often a process of bringing other people along with that. That's something I often talk about in a business context. If a manager is doing something like the ideal inventory, they may see, for instance, that they want to spend less time micromanaging. They're going to give people more responsibility. They're going to focus on what's really relevant to the business. The moment they do that, the people they've been micromanaging are going to be coming to them being like, oh, like you need to look at this, or like, why aren't you watching what the, there's going to be that demand from other people. Like, oh, you should be spending time on this thing you were spending time on before. And so we've always got to articulate this change and bring other people along. It's going to be an important part of it. Mm-hmm. So really think about, communication and other people, and you might need to add other people onto the inventories. And that might sometimes mean that some people you were spending a lot of time with on the first one, kind of a smaller on the other one, but then also thinking about supports, what are those connections you're growing on that second ideal inventory?
Dude, this has been really good stuff. We've had you on a couple of times, and I think it's been a lot of fun having you on to talk about one specific thing. And we had you on during a freaking pandemic. I mean, that's part of why we brought you on in 2020, was because everybody was, one, we were all bored, and two, we were all going through this new thing, and Adam and I really wanted to help people kind of learn how to navigate the choppy waters that were the early stages of the pandemic. And then the second time we had you on was the day after my second COVID shot. And so that was like a monumental day. And so we were kind of, heading our way out a little bit, although I think we were a little bit ahead of you here in the States versus Canada, where you were at the time. But, to have you come on and be singularly focused with us on one topic and one that we've referenced a lot has been a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you guys for the opportunity to focus on that. Right? It is useful to kind of dig into these things. So, I appreciate, the opportunity to chat about it, but also how you've been exploring these exercises and sharing about them. They really are only something we understand through practice. Mm-hmm. That you're putting in that practice and then, really exploring, like, what's this like in the real world is phenomenal. So thank you.
I brought up that you were in Canada, and now we know now that you're in Malaysia. Well, we said before we started recording, we were going to talk about all your jet setting, and we never brought it up at the very beginning. Like, I hit record and then we totally forgot all about it. You've been all over the place, and is this just like a screw COVID? We got vaccines now. I'm just going to go work this job virtually from every corner of the world, because you've been in Colombia. Now you're in Malaysia. You're in a hotel eating buffets with food from every corner of the Eastern world. What's going on with Mark Freeman?
Yeah, it's not usually like that. I try to do a minimal amount of jetting. Really, and actually I do. I actually travel much less by plane now than when I was, you know, living in one place. And then I would travel a bunch for like consulting gigs and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, very much I travel very slowly. I stay in one place. Like, I'll be in Malaysia for 2 months, and then I'll stay in Asia for several months before I have to fly on again. And it wasn't a screw COVID or something like that. In fact, most of the places I've been, like, actually, yeah, Malaysia's completely masked up.
Okay.
So yeah, it's quite different in a lot of the places I've been from North America. I was living in Mexico for a while, but Mexico was, was still like your hand, you know, hand sanitizer at the door to every restaurant, masked up in the streets. It's really been an opportunity to spend a lot of time hiking.
Nice.
Spend a lot of time in nature, connect with, kind of the beautiful world we have, and also, yeah, really minimize the amount of stuff I have. So I have 2 bags, and nomadic, wandering person. Whatever kind of, I am kind of in this unusual job or this unusual role of working with people around the world as they navigate changes. And it made sense to be out in the world, going on adventures as well. And so that's what I do. So I'll do it, indefinitely.
Any plans to go back to Canada and just stay there? I ask because, so this is stupid. I want to come up to Toronto and run the Toronto Marathon 1 year. And I hope that you're there in Toronto when I do it, because I'd like to meet you in person instead of just telling you your beard is good on Instagram a couple times a month.
Oh, I appreciate it. No, thank you. So one of the reasons, in before the pandemic, I used to do workshops. And so, yeah, I'm really fortunate to have a community of people spread out around the world. And so part of this was too, as the pandemic, reduces, as, you know, people have more access to vaccines, I'll be doing, you know, in-person workshops and things like that again. Mm-hmm. Or maybe like in-person hiking adventures where we get to take our brains on walks in the wild. And yeah, definitely doing in-person events is part of this. Like this kind of frees me up to go where it's useful and where we can do things. So yeah, I mean, I might be in Toronto again. Toronto's a great city. But also I'll be in other places. I'm sure I'll be in the United States as well. Being more nomadic and more mobile, part of that was freeing me up to do longer meditation retreats. And so, yeah, there's a bunch of great locations in the U.S. where I hope to do some meditation retreats in the year ahead. But yeah, not having a place that I need to take care of makes it much easier to, you know, go and sit in a temple for a couple weeks.
Right.
Just sit. Mm-hmm. So sometime I'll be in North America again, for sure. They have good food there too.
We do, yes.
Well, yeah. I'm just going to throw this out there. The number two ranked national park in the country is Cuyahoga Valley National Park here in Ohio, Northeast Ohio specifically.
Really?
So there is probably there, like 20 minutes from me. And I guarantee you there are great places in nature to meditate there that are quiet. There's free campgrounds and stuff there. And
that sounds amazing.
It is. And we have a lot of good food here in Northeast Ohio.
We do.
So very underrated place. Just don't come in December, January, February, or March or April.
Yeah.
The time you're going through right now.
Yes.
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah. I would love to check it out.
Well, Mark, I really appreciate you coming on again with us. Where can people find out more about yourself, what you do, and order your books?
Yeah, I think I have a website at markfreeman.ca. You can find me on Instagram at Mark W. Freeman. Those are probably the best places.
Okay.
I feel like I was on markfreeman.ca recently, and I was we're on the front page. It's been a long time since you've updated that.
I don't update it. That's right. Probably Instagram is updated more frequently.
Yes, you're on there all the time, and you do like live streams and stuff to talk about dealing with mental health, and that you do that on YouTube, right? Or do you...
I do that on YouTube? Yeah, and so on YouTube, my channel is Everybody Has a Brain.
Okay, that's a fact. So,
true.
All right. Well, Mark, I wish you the best in many more buffets at your hotel there in Malaysia. And
thank you.
I appreciate you again coming on, and we'll find more topics, and we'll bring you on again because we enjoy this every time. So
yeah, it's always a good talk.
Safe travels, and come to Cuyahoga Valley National Park. It's a great place to be.
It sounds amazing. I'd love to. Adam, Andrew, thank you so much. It was great exploring this with you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Mark.
Well, that is going to do it for us this week. Adam, I will see you soon. Mark, thank you again. And to everybody listening out there, feel free to like, subscribe, review us on your favorite podcast platforms. Go follow Mark on Instagram at Mark W. Freeman. And until we see you again, enjoy those miles, everybody.